Good morning, everyone. I think we're ready to make a start. It is still so wonderful to see an almost record number of people in the place. And up until a minute ago, we also had a record number of microphones, my personal experience. We had five, but now we're down to a mere four. So I'm sure that'll be enough to carry us forward. So then, the same subject, obviously, in general theme. We're looking at the idea of growing closer to God. And this morning we've got the title selected, Recognize My Methods. And in particular, we're going to look at the story of Ruth. We're looking at Ruth's situation then is not so much a moral one particularly. We realized yesterday Jonah had a sort of a moral separation from God because he had a bunch of attitudes which were destructive to him being close to God. Ruth's circumstances are a little bit more simple, I suppose, in that she is merely alienated from God in the sense that she didn't grow up in a culture of learning about Israel's God. And that may be true for you. There's a good number of us who grew up in a culture quite distinct from that which is learning about God. And yet even those of us who are within this culture can sometimes still feel alienated, can still feel, I don't really feel like I fit here. I can feel like a bit of a misfit for sometimes. So if that's something that might affect you or a mindset with which you're familiar, why then that too makes it appropriate to look at the case of Ruth. This is not a culture I recognize, is Ruth's situation. So open your Bibles, if you will, to the book of Ruth, and let's just familiarize ourselves with the circumstances. And what we're going to look at particularly is a couple of unusual circumstances that happen, in particularly with Ruth's approach to Boaz in the night. So let's just take a little reading from Ruth chapter 3 and verses 1 through 10. Then Naomi, Ruth's mother-in-law, said to Ruth, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our kinsman? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore wash yourself and anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be, when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do." And she said to her, "All that you say to me I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Now it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and there was a woman lying at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" So she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a near kinsman." Then he said, "Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich." So that's a very unusual set of circumstances by which Boaz and Ruth meet each other. And we might be prompted to ask, what on earth was Ruth doing? I mean, she was following the instructions of her mother-in-law, Naomi, for sure. But what was she doing with this strange protocol of coming to Boaz in the night and uncovering his feet? Let's explore this a little bit. And there's a couple of Hebrew words that we're going to want to meet because they're very instructive in our understanding of this circumstance. "I'm your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." Now that's from the New International Version. That's why you have those four words, "corner of your garment." Bit of a clumsy phrase that. I don't know what else. Does anyone have anything different in a translation down there? Skirt. I heard skirt. Is that the King James? Any others?
Covering.
Yes. So there's a couple of alternatives. Covering we had from there, and some of the others I've put down. Spread your skirt over your handmaid from the King James. And I read from the New King James, take your maidservant under your wing. Now that may sound like it's got a bit metaphorical and paraphrased, but I think the New King James has done a very good job here. All of them are valid, of course. The Hebrew word kanaf, and it may well be the root of the English word canopy, okay, which is obviously has a different pronunciation. The whole idea is that there's part of the skirt which is seen as a canopy, seen as a covering. And just from the point of view of Hebrew, the idea of translating this wing is fully valid. That is to say that the two arms, if you will, on a bird are spoken of in Hebrew using this same word. It is the same word for the wing of a bird. The canopy of a bird is the canopy of the skirt. So she really is saying, in the true metaphorical sense, take me under your wing. So that's quite important language there. It's also worthwhile knowing that this is, and it's imprinted in scriptural language as well as Hebrew culture, the idea of it's a known engagement custom. Spread the corner of your garment, spread that canopy over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer. That's very much duplicated in Ezekiel, where God speaks of taking Israel as his bride and his loved one. When I looked at you and I saw that you were old enough for love, says God, I spread that canopy, that wing, that corner of the garment over you and covered your nakedness. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Sovereign Lord, and you became mine. I dressed you in fine linen and covered you with costly garments. I adorned you with jewelry. And one more thing we should add to understanding the language there, and I think Brother John mentioned it often, it's worth knowing about what the Hebrew words are. Often there's a lot of wordplay going on. And there's some wordplay going on here, that she uncovers his feet before she lies down, and then she lies down and says, well, please cover me because you are a kinsman redeemer. Again, in the Hebrew, those are actually opposite words. What she does is the Hebrew gala, to uncover, and then she asks him to ga'al her. So you see, I do gala, and it's almost like the little child's game of peekaboo, right? Cover, uncover. And she's saying, I have gala, you should ga'al. And ga'al is a word that you might be familiar with in a different participle form as goel. It's the same word that Job cries out when he says, I know that my redeemer lives. He's saying, I know that my coverer lives. So she says, I have uncovered you, would you then please cover me? Which is very much an introduction to this engagement custom, but also has that attractive symmetry going on. And so that's perhaps explaining why she's uncovered him first, because the action of the redeemer in Hebrew is called the coverer. So she is showing, I am uncovered. What happens now? I have no source of income. I have no source of support. I have no defender. I am uncovered. And by uncovering his feet, why, maybe there's something a little extra going on. Well, I think what she's communicating now is a very important emotional concept. She's saying, well, I'm part of your family, and I'm uncovered. And surely when I'm uncovered, don't you feel that part of you is uncovered? And I think that's why she's uncovered his feet. Probably also helped him to wake up during the night if he had his feet cold. Otherwise, he'd have slept soundly till morning, and daylight's come, and there she is, and oh, hi, is there any coffee? And so that's, this isn't going to work so well. So I think that's what she's doing. But again, most importantly, pointing at this concept, do you feel that part of you is uncovered when I am uncovered? God heard the Israelites groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked down on the Israelites and was concerned about them. That's the same emotional resonance that's being noted here. When God's people are subjected to pain and discomfort, God himself feels pain and discomfort. There is that emotional connection. So we're learning a little bit about God. And Ruth has already learned that in how the family dynamic should work, or Naomi taught her. And so you have that connection there. And in fact, it goes even bigger than that, doesn't it? We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. So it's saying, actually realize, says Paul, the entire creation is gala, is uncovered, is in an imperfect state, because it's waiting for that perfect resonance. It's waiting for the return of the Creator so that things can be restored to a state of harmony and beauty. And not just Eden restored. We're not going backwards in time to something that was perfect. It was never perfect. It was always incomplete. We are pushing forward to a time of actual perfect completion and connection with the Creator, a time that has never been. But at this time, we're in the whole creation is said to be in a time of pain or childbirth because that situation is not established. And I think there's another reason. There's an awful lot going on in that little night's action. I think there's another reason why... No, we have a surprise. Oh, that's not so good. I think there's another reason why that particular language is used by Ruth. I think she's actually very cleverly responding to something that Boaz has said a couple of months earlier. Let's see if we can explore what Boaz has been saying. Boaz says to Ruth, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." And it's not obvious in the English, but it is obvious in the Hebrew, that those wings, of course, that are mentioned right there in Ruth chapter 2, is the same Hebrew word as what Ruth asks Boaz to put over her. So Boaz has said to her, "I see that you have come to take refuge under the Karnaf, the canopy of the God of Israel." And she says to him that night, "Yes, and would you spread your canopy over me?" So there's actually a little bit more. It's actually a very deep interplay of ideas that's going on here. As we read through quickly in English, sometimes we miss these associations. And I think they are very, very important. Ruth is responding partly to this comment of Boaz that he's made earlier at a different harvest. And so the question is prompted, therefore, what wings exactly do you think that Boaz was referencing? Any ideas? A little louder, that was probably right. Yes, the wings of Yahweh. And in what form, Dwight or anyone, in what form would Boaz have seen those wings physically? Yeah, he would have seen or would have known about, certainly, the wings that were made on the cherubim of the ark. Whether that's exactly right as a representation, I'm not qualified to know. But it gives the idea that, let's go through the detail from Exodus 25, "And you shall make two cherubim of gold. Of hammered work you shall make them at the two ends of the mercy seat. And the cherubim shall stretch out their wings above, covering the mercy seat with their wings." So that's the relevance of the wings. It's not just, oh look, there's some wings on this thing. The relevance is the wings indicate where the focus of the mercy of God is to be found. And that's not to say that the mercy of God isn't spread throughout the universe, for it is. But the presence of God and the mercy of God, by his own design, is brought to an intense focus. And that intense focus is located beneath the canopy of the cherubim, beneath the wings of the cherubim. Boaz sees God's mercy. And so, because he's a godly man, he's learned to talk in godly language. And so when he sees Ruth appealing to the mercy of the God of Israel, he uses that language. "I see that you've come to shelter under the wings of Yahweh, the God of Israel." And he also says this interesting thing, which ties in as well, and we'll see how. "The Lord bless you, my daughter," Boaz replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor." Now this gets complicated because in different translations a different sense is given to this. But what I'm suspecting from this particular translation is that Boaz is identifying her not going after the men of her own generation as the first kindness. and now she's shown him a second kindness, which is even greater. So if that's true, and the translations give a different sense, not all translations give that sense, I openly acknowledge, but if that's true, if the first kindness was Ruth not favoring the younger man, and not saying, well, I must have a young, healthy man as of my own generation as I am, what then is the greater kindness that she's now shown to Boaz? And I think that will tie in with exactly what we've just been looking at. So let me paraphrase what's happened so far. Boaz says to Ruth, you have come to take refuge under the wings of the God of Israel. And then on that one signature night, Ruth has said to Boaz, can I find refuge under your wings? With clear implication, yes, I can. I can find refuge under your wings. Well, if that's the case, Ruth is then implying that Boaz is a godly man by this very clever, very subtle, and still romantic language. She's saying, yes, I have come to shelter under the wings of the God of Israel, and for that reason, I request to take shelter under your wings, because I see a connection, I see a reflection of the characteristics of the God of Israel in you, the man Boaz. And I think that's what's going on, where Boaz recognizes he's smart enough to pick up on this language and pick up on this interplay. And he says, thank you, that is your second kindness. That is greater than the kindness that you showed me just by not going after a man of your own generation. The kindness that you've shown me, the implication that I do make a reflection of the God that I try to serve. So in all of that, there's an awful lot going on. I find this a really beautiful story, not just as a love story, but as the really intelligent interplay of them using these Hebrew terms that are connected to the God of Israel to have this kind of almost private conversation that only someone very connected to the God of Israel would be able to understand. And that's just a very attractive thing. And so what happens next? What happens is simple enough. Boaz marries Ruth. Today you are witnesses, he announces to the townsfolk, that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses. This is a very important part of the story of covering, of the story of shelter. Why is this so important? It's the practical reality. The story of Boaz and Ruth isn't just about pretty words. It's about actually physically taking care of those that are in need and taking care. Boaz marries Ruth. He redeems her. There was a closer relative who was interested about the idea of gaining the extra property. But when he was told that there was other people he'd have to take care of and other people he'd have to share this new wealth with and raise up their name, he wasn't so interested anymore, and so he passed by on the other side, if you will. But Boaz, who was second in line for this redemption, was very keen to take on the task not only of marrying Ruth and taking care of her, but also of raising up children to Mahlon's name, that he would keep Mahlon, the dead husband, alive in the records of the children of Israel. Boaz gives life to the dead man, Mahlon. Boaz doesn't have the power to resurrect him from the dead, but you kind of feel that if he did, he would. He's done everything he can to keep this dead man alive or to return this dead man to some sort of state of existence within the records of the land of Israel. Boaz knows, therefore, that to be close to God, he must actually do what God does. And I think that's the simplest part of growing closer to God, is doing what God does. We'll expand on that a great deal on Thursday, but for now we'll just introduce it as a hanging concept and see that that's certainly how Boaz has conducted himself. He's seen essentially an orphan and a widow, for Ruth is both, and he's seen a dead man, Mahlon. And he has, to the fullest extent of his limited abilities, given life to the dead in keeping Mahlon's name alive in the records and raising up children for him and keeping his property divided as part of his. And he has given shelter to the widow, who is Ruth. And he has given shelter to the orphan, who is Ruth. So he has taken care of widows and orphans, and he has given life to the dead man. There is a practical reality to growing closer to God. There is a practical reality that must accompany any kind words and intelligent phrases that we interchange between us, as Boaz and Ruth had done. I have also acquired Ruth as my wife, so that Mahlon's name will not disappear from among his family. It's an echo of that man who said, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. Now those are the words of Jesus, and he has power to give life in a much more real and powerful way than ever Boaz did. But you can see that Boaz has really tried to do as much as he can. And so I think this gives an interesting solution to a very obscure verse back in Genesis. This might seem to be a strange segue. And it's useful now to consider the man Onan. Here's the verse, it's here in Genesis 38. Onan knew, when he was asked, some backstory is needed, his brother had died being married to his wife Tamar, and so Onan had taken Tamar to wife, as the Jewish law instructed him to do. But Onan knew that the offspring of himself and Tamar would not be his. It would be credited to his brother who was dead. So whenever he lay with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from producing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight. So the Lord put Onan to death as well. And so I think it's worth thinking about those verses in the light of what we've seen in Boaz and Ruth. Why did God kill Onan? And some parts of Christianity have said, well, it's all to do with the sexual mechanics of the situation. God clearly doesn't like contraception. And so some parts of Christianity have gone down that road. And these are the verses on which those thoughts are based. Because Onan clearly practiced some form of contraceptive behavior, and God put him to death. While those facts are true, I don't think that's the point. The point is, what Onan had done, would he take an ownership of a mindset that was exactly opposite to Jesus Christ? When Jesus Christ sees a dead brother, like Lazarus, his desire is to bring him to life. But when Onan saw his own dead brother, a brother in the flesh as much as ever in the house of Israel, he did everything he could so that he wouldn't bring him back to life. Because any children of Onan and Tamar's would start gaining wealth for his brother and not for himself. And that's why he didn't want to have children with Tamar. And that's why he did what he did. Did he make God furiously angry so that God smote him in his anger? I don't think so. I think God is far more calm than that. God has said, I've seen what you've selected. You've selected the mindset and the lifestyle that is the complete opposite of my son. My son is the resurrection and the life. And so if you've chosen the opposite, why, you must be death. So he put him to death because that's what he'd chosen. I don't think there's any blazing anger involved. It's just that beautiful symmetry of be careful what you wish for. Whatever mindset you adopt, you will gain the reality and the ultimate consequence of that life. And that's why Onan died. So I see Onan as a beautiful opposite to Boaz in their life choices and the eventual consequences that they reap from them. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife. And then time passes. A number of generations pass by. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of King David. Now, why does it... So Ruth is David's, great-grandmother. Okay, and given the timescales over which they reproduced, it's strongly likely that Ruth would have known David personally. They would have had a personal relationship. They would have existed at the same time. That's not quite so true today, simply because of socioeconomic reasons in Western countries. We generally wait a lot longer to have children. So as a result, most of you in the room will have known your grandparents and will come to know your grandchildren. Most of you in the room will not have known your great-grandparents, nor will know your great-grandchildren. In fact, let's just check that's true. I could be hopelessly disproven. Raise your hands if you were alive at the same time and knew your grandparents. Okay, grandparents. Now, only keep your hands up. Oh, keep your hands up. Don't get tired. This is not too physical. Don't worry. It's not the volleyball tournament. Now, only keep your hands up if you knew your great-grandparents. I'm hoping most hands go down. And they do. Good. So, and I don't think... So raise your hands if you currently know your grandchildren. Very good. So less hands. And so put your hands down if you don't know your great-grandchildren. We don't have any great-grandchildren. And there's just a few hands left. So that's about right. That's about on the cusp of where of our generational overlaps. You can put your last hand down now. And I'm you'll get tired if you haven't taken the trigger yet. Maybe you have more generations. You were just waiting for me to go on. You're obviously doing well. Your family is strong. Okay, so the point of that is simply to say, when we hear about great-grandparents, we usually think, oh yeah, that's someone they wouldn't have known. And that's true today in Western civilization. But there's no doubt that Ruth knew David. Now, what do you think? Wouldn't that have been a wonderful family story? The meeting of Boaz and Ruth. And we know it's a wonderful story. My goodness, it's still encoded in Scripture to this day. I have little doubt that Ruth would have sat her children, her grandchildren, and her great-grandchildren, even David, on her knee, and told him of those stories of how they met. And there's some evidence that that did happen, whether the oral tradition was carried down in the family by remote persons or whether directly, I guess, doesn't matter that much. And it's so evident because David, and David alone, uses the language of sheltering under the wings. Let's look at some examples. Psalm 17, he speaks to the Lord his God. Keep me as the apple of your eye. Hide me in the shadow of your wings. And that, of course, is that same Hebrew word every time, by the way, the canopy word. And that's a psalm of David. And you won't find psalms of Asaph with this language. You won't find psalms of Solomon with this language, interestingly. You won't find psalms of anyone else with this language. There's more examples, not just one. How priceless is your unfailing love. Both high and low among men, find refuge in the shadow of your wings. Psalm 36. That's another psalm of David. And there's more. I long to dwell in your tent forever and take refuge in the shelter of your wings. Psalm 61. And we could go on. In total, in fact, there are 7 psalms that include this language. And 6 of the psalms say that they are psalms of David. And the 7th psalm says the author of this psalm is unknown. Well, not to me, it isn't. I recognize this language. There's only one man who's used this language. And I believe, and I can't prove, it doesn't matter so much, but I believe it's the story of Boaz and Ruth that makes this metaphor so valuable to David and makes it so much at the forefront of his language that he uses it in those 3 psalms there and also in a few others. And I think that's because Ruth had followed this command of the Lord. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, and so on and so on. And Ruth had clearly seen how God had worked in her life. And this is one of those reminders, this is one of those indicators of how we grow closer to God. Share the stories of how God has worked in your life. Ruth did. Look at the effect it had on her great-grandson. And what greater great-grandson could you have than King David? And look how she has affected him with that wonderful story of a godly connection with a godly man that she made. I think that this whole story also helps us clear up what is also another of those tiny little mysteries that shows up in Scripture. Do you remember this story? King Saul is chasing David as he spent a great deal of his time and energy doing, and he's chased him into the wilderness. I forgot which wilderness, doesn't matter. And David goes to hide in a cave, and Saul bizarrely comes into the very same cave to, it says, relieve himself. And whether that means his toilet or means going to sleep, I don't know. I presume it means he actually went to sleep and to rest. And so Saul is actually resting in the front part of the cave, and David, the man he's hunting, is hiding in the back. And so in fact, as David is fleeing from Saul, he writes one of those psalms. This is another one, Psalm 57. He writes, have mercy on me, O God, have mercy on me, for in you my soul takes refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. And the disaster is Saul's homicidal hunting campaign that he's going on, that he's hunting David in clear order to kill him. And this is where Saul takes rest. And so David sneaks up on Saul, and you might remember he cuts a piece off his robe. Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. And those words might seem rather bizarre when you just encounter them in the middle of 1 Samuel. Like, what's he so bothered about? I mean, you know why he's cut the piece off the robe. He just wants to prove to Saul, look, I was close enough to you to kill you, and I didn't. Will you please stop trying to kill me? On a separate occasion, he takes a spear and a water jug to prove the same thing. Right? But on this occasion, and when he took the king's spear and he took the king's water jug, he wasn't conscience-stricken about it, nor should he have been. But on this occasion, having cut off the canopy, having cut off the wings of the robe, it cuts him to the heart, one of the translations said. Why is that? And I think we now know the answer. He suddenly realized that that little trophy that he gained just to prove to Saul, I could have killed you and I didn't, is actually that very thing that he's been delighting in all these years. That same part of the robe that Ruth had said to Boaz, that his great-grandmother had said to his great-grandfather, cover me. Cover me with that canopy. That canopy which is the same as the canopy of the cherubim under which the focal point of mercy can be found. So in a way, that canopy of the robe was the part that everyone had in those days as a symbol for how they could show mercy, how they could spread that canopy over another and take them under their wing. And that was the bit that David had sliced off from Saul. And I think that's why he's conscience-stricken, because he's taken away that very part of Saul's clothing, which is Saul's metaphorical ability to show mercy. Ironically, Saul, of course, never had any intention of showing mercy to David. Isn't that interesting? So it's like, you know, the pattern is completed. Saul never really deserved to have a canopy to his robe because he refused to spread it over another. Nevertheless, David knew it wasn't his place to take it away. And so he's conscience-stricken for having so done. And I think that now gives me a better understanding of that otherwise rather puzzling little verse. Don't obstruct others' efforts to be merciful is the spiritual lesson that hides in that physical interplay there in 1 Samuel 24. And then we come, of course, to the final son of David. I told you, didn't I, that David was the only one who used that language. There's an exception to be made. He was the only one in the Old Testament to use that language. But there was another son of David, another descendant of Ruth, if you will, who was very struck by the power and the import of the language of talking about spreading the covering canopy. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, said Jesus of Nazareth, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Not the Hebrew word there, of course, because we don't have a Hebrew record of those particular words, but you can see it's the same language. And I think even this helps us solve another curious, mysterious detail that shows up in the scripture. Think about this. Did you ever wonder why that was so important? This is from the crucifixion. The garment that Jesus had on was seamless, woven into one piece from top to bottom. So the soldiers said, well, let's not tear this garment then. Let's gamble, let's cast some lots to see who will get it. The garment was never divided. Do we see now what that means? The canopy could not be sliced off the robe of the Lord Jesus Christ. His wings were never amputated, not even in death. And how beautiful that is on the spiritual plane, that the man, even when he was dead, had the ability to cover, or to say it this way, in his death, he covered and sheltered as many, if not more, than he had ever covered and sheltered in his life. Unlike Saul, who didn't deserve the canopy to the robe, and David confessed it wasn't his place to cut it off, the robe, the canopy of the robe of the Lord Jesus Christ, was never sliced off. His wings have never been amputated. He's always been able to shelter. He's always been able to cover. And part of the reason that God has enabled him to be that way is because of the verses above, because he's always had the desire to shelter and the desire to cover. And that's a good lesson for me, and therefore for you too. If we have the desire to shelter, the desire to cover, then according to these verses, proportionally, God will grant us the opportunities to enact those desires. God rejoices when he sees those with a godly desire, and he creates opportunities in which we can serve and cover those who are in need of covering. As an eagle stirs up its nest, hovers over its young, spreading out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings, so the Lord alone led Israel. And you'll see there the spread out wings, and that's the same canopy word, the spread out wings of the bird, by which the Lord bears up Israel. And we've introduced another little verb there, though. That little verb hovers. The verb describes what you see in that verb. What you see in that verb in Deuteronomy 32 in the physical sense is this idea of a hovering, almost fretful parent. And I'm not saying that's the best parenting style. I wouldn't know. I'm not a parent. In fact, you know, sometimes the ever-hovering parent isn't the best style. But what we do see here is that is how God is over the nest of his young. He's ever hovering, ever watchful, ever seeing if there are needs that need to be taken care of. And there's a very beautiful place where this verb to hover first shows up. Does anyone know where it first shows up in the Bible? Absolutely. Right there at the start. It's a very rare word. It only shows up three times in the whole Bible, the other time in Jeremiah. And it's given us the same picture. The earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God, and I think in the King James it says moved, which is rather an inadequate translation. The Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. God had created something. And he was so moved by the beauty and the power of what he had done, he hovered over the top of it. Just, you can think, as a parent looks to the child they love, what tremendous opportunities might arise from this situation of what I have done. And that's the same spirit that God has as he hovered over his young child. You get that picture then, don't you? That over the whole world, God has spread his eagle's wings. And we are all covered and sheltered by that metaphor introduced as early as the second verse of the scriptures themselves. It's a wonderful picture, isn't it? Here's another famous picture that gives us some more guiding advice to ourselves with which we can finish. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. I'm sure those are the favorite words of Scripture of a good number of people in this world, and rightly so. But now that we've explored everything that we've learned from Boaz and from Ruth and from David, we can add an extra dimension, a deeper dimension of understanding to what those verses are saying. In metaphorical terms, it's saying this, just in a picture. It's saying, we can ascend to heaven. And that's what we desire to do, ascend to heaven. And before the committee convenes an emergency meeting, you understand that in a metaphorical sense, right? Heaven being the presence of God. We desire to grow closer to God. We want to ascend to heaven, i.e. learn to fly, and we learn to fly by spreading our wings. And when you think of the physical interpretation of that metaphor, it's so simple, it's so stupid, it's almost just a truism. Of course you fly up to the sky by spreading your wings. We see the birds do that. And that's the language that Isaiah 40 employs. But having seen what we've seen in this class so far, we can translate that by saying this. We ascend to heaven, grow closer to God, i.e. learn to fly, develop his character, by spreading our wings. And we now have a direct interpretation of what that means. Whenever we show mercy. Whenever we show mercy and the covering that's needed over those who have no covering. Whenever we do that, God sees us spreading our wings. And Isaiah 40 says, those who spread their wings will learn to fly. Self-evident. And those who learn to fly will ascend to heaven, will grow closer to their God. So there's really quite a beautiful and yet explicit sense in which these metaphors now translate in our Bibles. How then do Ruth and Boaz grow closer to God? Let's summarize what we've seen so far. Ruth refused to leave the community where God was active. To her, it was a pearl of great price. Even when natural circumstances conspired to where she would have returned to Moab and not come to Israel, she knew somehow about the sheltering wings. And it was those that she sought, the sheltering wings of the God of Israel, which God we have the privilege to serve too. Boaz showed the character of God in spreading his wings, in providing real and substantial help to those without food, shelter, and protection. He had the desire to provide that covering, which interestingly is also known as the atonement seat. Ruth placed herself close to those who displayed God's character. That was her tactic, and what a good lesson that is, certainly for our younger people who might be seeking a partner. One of the ways that the phrases is often used, and I think wisely so, is whatever bait you use determines whatever fish you catch. Right? And Ruth knew exactly what she wanted to catch. She wanted to catch a godly man. And so she set about her pursuit of a husband and her pursuit of a partner entirely according to those principles. And Ruth ended up strongly encouraging her great-grandson, King David, of course, which tells us the same thing. We will strongly affect the lives and the opinions and the value systems of those to whom we give birth and those who are in the generations below us. How can I learn from Ruth and Boaz's experience? Well, I can try and embody Ruth. Never leave the community where God is working. That's what Ruth did. She knew the community where God was working, and that's why even though she belonged somewhere else, as I belong somewhere else, I belong in spiritual Moab, no, I want to stay in the community where God is working. Where is that community? There is that community. That's the community where God is working. You know that as well as I do. So don't leave. And it's, of course, very easy to want to leave at some times. Sometimes are very painful. Sometimes are hard. Sometimes you get insulted. Sometimes you really get hurt and disillusioned. Don't leave. Times of famine certainly came. They came for Ruth. Times of bereavement will come. They came for Ruth. But she knew, don't quit on the community where God is working. That's how you stay close to your God. Embody Boaz. Provide shelter for those who have none. It was great to hear very timely the announcement from Brother Bruce and Christadelphian Neil Aday. Ask about their projects. Ask about their projects providing shelter. Get involved. Learn to spread your wings. I know many of you already do, of course. But there are many projects in which we can spread our wings. Provide food and a stable environment, a stable, loving environment for those who have none. These are some of the projects with orphans that are in the townships of South Africa. These projects are available and they need staffing and support. You can spread your wings and learn to become just like Boaz in that area. Embody Ruth, teach our children. That's certainly something we must do. Teach the children that we have. This is a photograph, a little backstory on this if I may. This was taken, it won't surprise you, in Vietnam. And this is the Vietnamese Bible school, which actually has to be held in secret so that the authorities don't discover and arrest. And they have, unfortunately, discovered some and arrested some. There's no one in jail right now. But this is the Vietnamese Bible school, and due to logistical difficulties, you know, we worry about a microphone here and a PowerPoint there. Now, their logistical difficulties are much larger. And we lost the whole first day. It hadn't been able to happen. So this is day two. And the decision was made, wasn't up to me, to compress all of the classes from day one and day two into day two. So there was a double dose of classes. I see some of you shudder at the very idea. That's right. The same number of meals, but double classes. Yeah, it's a horror story come true. And these children, and before any of the classes are given, all the children are gathered up, and they do 45 minutes of daily readings first. So there were supposed to be two classes per day, but in this day there were four classes. This photograph was taken during the last class. So this is the fifth hour of Bible study. The children don't go out to separate classes. There's no arts, there's no crafts, there's no playtime. They sit and they read their Bibles and they take notes and they follow along. And there they are. I've distracted the girl on the right with my camera, otherwise she was as focused as any of the others. And there they are in the fifth hour of Bible study in that day. And they're absolutely an inspiration for me, an inspiration hopefully to our community, for just how dedicated you can be. If you're interested, the girl in red in the center of the frame there is 10 years old. The girl on the right in pink, who I've distracted, is 8. I don't know the ages of the others, but I think they're peers. I think they're sort of 8, 9, 10 years old. You can probably also see they don't have any backs on those chairs, so they can't lean back and relax like many of you are doing right now. Okay? They're on little plastic stools that would barely hold my body weight, which is a matter of concern for another time. And they just sat on those little plastic stools, and they sat there, and they were absolutely fabulous. What a wonderful example they were to me and to all of us who came. If Ruth can powerfully encourage a great-grandson, I don't know why Putsch never met. I've early argued she did. Whoops. How much more can our children be encouraged by godly parents now? The principle, nevertheless, is the same. We will have an effect, and a strong effect, on the value system. We'll have little anecdotes that will stay with our children, with our grandchildren, and will affect the way they think about their God moving forward. Those, then, are our thoughts on Ruth and growing closer to God from a position of alienation and a foreign culture. And tomorrow we're going to address a situation that probably strikes very deeply at the heart of every one of us. The idea of depending on oneself, refusing to give up control. How much does that affect particularly those in Western civilization? We're looking, of course, at the man Jacob, the man Israel, who wrestled even with God under the subject heading, Trust My Strength.